This is a segment of the Jodcast. For the full show and archives, go to www.jodcast.net.
Physicists and astronomers like taking things to the extreme, because that's when our current understanding of physics and astronomy can break down, leading us to develop and improve our understanding of nature. This Jodcast interview is all about extreme physics.
What I'm talking about is the kind of conditions that you don't easily reproduce in a laboratory.
Dr. Carol Mundell, Principal Lecturer at Liverpool John Moores University, Royal Society University Research Fellow and RC UK Academic Fellow.
So the two particular kinds of objects in the universe that I'm interested in are gamma-ray bursts and active galactic nuclei. And the two things that they appear to have in common is that they're driven by black holes. In the case of gamma-ray bursts, these are black holes that are about the mass of our sun, but concentrated into probably an area, a volume about, you know, 1 mile across. Mm-hmm. Supermassive black holes are at the centres of most bulge-dominated galaxies, and even the Milky Way has its own black hole, but the supermassive black holes that I'm interested in are about 100 million solar masses. So big, beefy things compared to the black holes that fuel gamma-ray bursts. But what both of these kinds of objects have in common is that when you actually try to get matter close to a black hole, then the matter heats up and it shines very brightly. And it's the light from that shining material that we catch with our telescopes on Earth. And in fact, that's the only way we can probe the physics around these extreme objects. We can't fly our satellites or our astronauts out to a supermassive black hole or a gamma-ray burst at the edge of the universe, but we catch the light and we use that light to disentangle the physics that are happening close to these black hole objects.
So these two fields are connected by black holes. You're just looking at a different size of black holes. So let's look at the first one. Let's look at gamma-ray bursts coming from solar mass black holes, you say.
Yes.
What are these gamma-ray bursts? Remind us what these things are.
Well, historically, they were discovered as flashes of gamma rays, and they're originally found by military satellites in the end of the 1960s. And these military satellites were monitoring the sky, really, to find particularly the Russians who might be violating the nuclear test ban treaties. Mm. And so, of course, the discovery of these gamma-ray flashes were classified for a number of years, while the Americans thought that they were the Russians detonating nuclear tests in their country. Mm. They were then discovered to come actually from the sky and not be terrestrial sources of gamma-ray flashes. And so the first paper came out in 1973 announcing the discovery of these very short but intense pulses of gamma rays on the sky. So they flash and they're gone. They don't repeat themselves.
Right.
Now, the problem in those days was that nobody knew where these were to better than many degrees, and so traditional telescopes couldn't then point and find the light that comes at other wavelengths in addition to the gamma rays.
It's a good point, though, isn't it? I mean, this is not normal, well, when we say normal light, it's all part of the same electromagnetic spectrum, but when we say gamma rays, can you explain what sort of energy levels we're talking about?
They're
here?
The very highest energy levels in the electromagnetic spectrum, and they're up at, well, we measure these in terms of electron volts, so X-rays are some round about kilo electron volts, a few kilo electron volts. The gamma rays are up into mega electron volts and giga electron volts. So you don't want to be standing in the way of a gamma ray when it comes through, it's going to fry you basically. But the Earth's atmosphere protects us from astrophysical gamma rays, luckily, because we now know that these gamma ray bursts are actually occurring in the universe. You know, we tend to detect them with our satellites a few times a week, but there may be as many as one a day happening. And with the advent of satellites that were then flown, for example, most recently the SWIFT satellite, which is a NASA satellite that was launched in 2004, specifically to catch these gamma ray flashes on the sky, localize them very accurately and send down their locations to ground-based telescopes instantly. So we don't have to wait a day or two by the time the light's faded away and we can't find them with our telescopes. Within seconds, we get a notification. And in fact, I get woken up in the middle of the night. My mobile phone will buzz and tell me that a gamma-ray burst has just been detected. And what we do at Liverpool is we have a suite of robotic telescopes on the island of La Palma in the Canary Islands, in Hawaii and also in Australia. These are 2-metre robotic telescopes, the world's largest robotic telescopes. And when a gamma-ray satellite sends down a signal to say, I found one of these gamma-ray flashes, it's at this part of the sky, and it has these properties, our telescopes immediately slew and point at that position and start to look at the optical light, so the lower energy light in the electromagnetic spectrum that our eyes are sensitive to. And we can then combine the knowledge that we have from that particular burst, how it looks in the gamma rays, then down into the X-rays, into the optical, the infrared light, and ultimately down into the radio regime. We put all of that together, and we also examine how the light varies with time to disentangle what actually occurred when this black hole, in the case of gamma ray bursts, it's the birth of a black hole as a massive star collapses at the edge of the universe.
This is the end of a star's life, or one possible end of a star's life.
That's right.
Is a gamma ray burst.
Exactly. So very massive stars, you know, maybe 100 or 200 solar masses, out at high redshift. I mean, there have been a few nearby ones, I say not very nearby, certainly not in our own galaxy, but we're looking at some of the most instantaneously luminous events in the universe in gamma ray bursts, and they are some of the highest redshift or the most distant objects that we've ever caught light from with our telescopes.
It seems spectacular that these things are the most, or some of the most luminous objects at any given instant, more luminous than an entire galaxy, so we understand. How is this possible that one star, okay, it's a very massive star, certainly, how is it that it could contain that much energy, even just for a split second of time?
Well, this was one big dilemma that the astronomical community had to wrestle with when the energies were first being measured. And the critical point, really, is how you put that light energy out. So do you emit the energy isotropically in the way that a light bulb does, so the light comes out in all directions, in which case the light that comes to the Earth is a small bit of that, and when you calculate the total amount of energy that comes from this object, it seems physically large. Mm. Alternatively, if you actually beam that energy and focus it into a small opening angle, the way a torch works, then the energy constraints become a little less extreme. The most extreme example that we've ever seen was a burst that happened in 1999, a gamma ray burst called 990123. It happened on the 23rd of January in 1999. Mm-hmm. And this thing reached nearly ninth magnitude in the visual band. So you could have seen it with binoculars if you looked at the right part of the sky.
Wow.
And the amount of energy that was inferred there was the rest mass energy of a neutron star had been emitted in just 80 seconds.
When you say the rest mass of a neutron star, what do you mean by that?
If you take the mass of an entire neutron star and you convert that straight into energy using Einstein's equals mc squared equation, then the amount of energy that we detected at the Earth was equivalent, if you convert it back into mass, to an entire neutron star being vaporized.
Does that suggest actually that's what happened? An entire neutron star got turned into energy, and that's what we saw as the gamma ray burst?
No, what we now understand is that the energy was actually focused into a torch-like beam, and that then means that and a whole neutron star did not have to die in 80 seconds for us to catch the light at the Earth. And instead, what we now understand is that there are very, very high ultra-relativistic, so very close to the speed of light, jets that get spewed out from these objects. I mean, these are massive spinning stars, and as their cores collapse, they then shoot out these jets of plasma. And the light comes from the plasma, but of course the light that we see is enhanced by the fact that it's moving so close to the speed of light, it gets an extra boost. It's called a Doppler boost.
Right.
And we actually see something that's then very bright because the torch is pointing right directly at us. And obviously if the torch is pointing away, we don't see anything. And so there are probably many gamma ray bursts happening in the universe that we don't catch because they just don't happen to be pointing directly at us.
The beams aren't pointing towards us.
Exactly.
Well, why is the plasma emitted from these collapse events? Why are these beams beamed? Why are they focused into these beams?
Well, this is one of the big unsolved questions in astrophysics, really, as to what launches these beams or these jets of material, be it in gamma ray bursts or active galactic nuclei like quasars, which, of course, they eject their plasma over much larger physical scales, and radio astronomers for many decades now have been making exquisite radio images using facilities like Merlin to actually image the radio plasma as it moves out from the centres of these supermassive black holes. And so there's a whole range of different kind of jets in the universe, both in our own galaxy coming from smaller stars and also right through into gamma ray bursts and AGN. And some of the theories around how these jets get formed are to do with magnetic fields at the centres of the objects. And if you have, if you think of magnetic fields as threads through the plasma, and obviously you have a spinning object and it starts to get twisted up, then maybe you make a funnel. And you have to balance energy. So if something is collapsing and it's also spinning and getting faster than and heating up, then that energy has to come out somewhere. And so there are various different theories, none of which have been conclusively proven yet as to how the central engines of these very energetic objects work. That's one of the big questions. What are the progenitors and what ultimately drives the central engine that squishes out this material at such extreme speeds?
Right. One question, though. Neutron stars, we like to think, are fairly stable objects. Once they become a star collapses and becomes a neutron star, doesn't it just stay a neutron star? Why does a neutron star decide it wants to become a black hole and thereby emit lots of radiation as a gamma ray burst?
Well, I think...
What pushes it over the edge?
Yeah, there are two issues here. I mean, one, obviously, is if you squeeze an awful lot of mass into a very small volume, you get to the stage where the thing called degenerate pressure, can no longer keep a neutron soup going. The black holes are actually much more massive in a much smaller volume than neutron stars. If you have enough material that collapses down, you get to a critical mass. And that material, although the black hole is commonly thought of in popular, popular imagination as a great cosmic vacuum cleaner. In fact, it's not. It's a dense object that just happens to have such a strong gravitational attraction that not even light can escape. So it's not an exotic object in that sense. It's just more massive and more concentrated than a neutron star. For gamma ray bursts, there's currently a debate going on as to whether they have neutron stars or black holes at their heart, or whether some gamma ray bursts may be an object called magnetars, so neutron stars that are nice and stable but have very strong, well-ordered magnetic fields, and the energy is then extracted from the magnetic fields to drive these outbursts, or whether you really do need a black hole at the centre as the powerhouse, if you like, for these explosions. And that's something that we're still currently investigating and trying to understand which... or both, maybe, lie at the heart of gamma ray bursts.
Lots to learn. So what you mentioned before, that you have a selection of robotic telescopes reacting automatically to these signals from the space telescopes, or where do you come in? You mentioned you get woken up at night by the universe going bang. What actually happens?
Well, indeed, the robotic telescopes do work completely automatically. So the signal comes directly from the satellite into the telescope. The telescope interrupts what it's doing immediately at that point and goes straight to the gamma ray burst. So in principle, if I slept through my buzzing telephone, it wouldn't be, the end of the world. The telescope would do its job. And in fact, we have a whole suite of sophisticated software that we've designed and implemented on these telescopes so that we take our optical images of the sky, we analyze them, we reduce them. The software goes in and finds all of the known stars in the field and it looks for a new object. If it finds a new object, it says, I think this might be the gamma ray burst, afterglow, the optical counterpart to the gamma ray flash itself. And is it fading? And then it compares images and sees whether the object's actually fading. And then I have a very nice little automatic email that I receive in my email inbox saying, I think I've found your optical transient. It's at this position. It's at this pixel location. It has this brightness. It may be fading at this rate. And here's the light curve that I'm growing of it. So, in fact, our telescopes do all this for us. But where the humans really come in, obviously, we can't be fast enough. There's no way that I can wake up in the middle of the night and within a minute or two make an intelligent decision as to what needs to be done with the telescopes, and that's why it's all fully automated. But as the first hour after the burst proceeds, you have a good idea about the properties of the optical object that you found. Sometimes we find nothing at all. We have an upper limit, and in which case it might be bright in the infrared, it might be a very high redshift, and therefore we won't see it in the optical. But I then have to take the images and add them together and dig a bit deeper, which is not something we ask the telescope to do in real time. Alternatively, it might have found something very bright that may be real. I check the images to make sure it's not just a bright star in the field, that it's not some kind of aberration. 99% of the time, it's a real afterglow that we found, probably better than 99% of the time. And obviously, the email that I get from the telescope helps me to make a decision faster and in the middle of the night, in my stupefied, half-asleep state. I then see the location of it, how bright it is, what its properties are, and it's then my job to send a circular to approximately 900 to 1,000 astronomers around the world saying, this is what we found, these are its properties, this is where it is. And you then have a number of other teams around the world who are also following up with their own telescopes, some of them robotic, some of them traditional. People then start to take spectra of these objects to try to find out what their redshift is, to see what elements might be associated close to the burst, where the material that's around the burst. And the programs to then continue to monitor how these objects fade across the electromagnetic spectrum can then kick in, where it's not so critical to get on within the first few minutes, but the next hour or the next few days might be very important. So the humans really make the strategic science decisions based on the properties that the robotic telescopes are telling us these bursts have. And we do a little bit of a sanity check. But as I say, mostly the telescope's better than I am.
Yes.
And the software's cleverer than I am in the middle.
The telescope's faster than you are, let's say. It's faster.
Certainly,
to react.
Yes.
So it sounds like these things, these burst events, are over very, very quickly. If you need a telescope to react to them automatically, and you've got a whole suite of people around the world ready with their telescopes to watch it as it fades, how long does it take for one of these burst events to be over, if it ever is over?
Well, it depends at what part of the electromagnetic spectrum you look. So there are two kinds of gamma ray bursts. There are the so-called long bursts, which we define to be flashes of gamma rays that last for longer than 2 seconds. There are short bursts, which last less than 2 seconds and can be as short as tens of milliseconds. The long bursts may go on for many tens, many hundreds, many thousands of seconds in the gamma rays, maybe up to 1,000 seconds, rarely more than that. That initial flash of gamma rays is produced in part of what we call the central engine. So in technical terms, it's internal shocks in the flow that produce the gamma ray emission. So very fast shells of plasma that catch one another up in the flow, a bit like racing car drivers overtaking one another, but crashing as they do so. And that's where we think the gamma ray flashes come from. Once these shells then meet the circumstellar material, so the material that is around the star, or maybe the outer layers of the star itself, we then have what's called an external shock, and this produces the afterglow. So the X-ray, the optical, the infrared, the radio emission, the so-called afterglow. So these are the dying embers, the fading source that we see associated with the gamma ray flash. And some of these objects can fade very quickly. So, for example, the burst that I mentioned that happened in 1999, that had already faded something like by 5 optical magnitudes in 10 minutes. So their speed is of the essence. Otherwise, it's very bright to begin with, but then you don't actually catch it if you're not there soon enough, and therefore you never know how bright it was. But the afterglows can go on for many days and weeks if your telescopes are sensitive enough to catch the fading light. So in some ways, they're over very quickly if you're catching the gamma rays. And if you want to really get a full picture of the physics that are happening, you want to catch light from across the electromagnetic spectrum as soon as possible, but also for as long as the object is technically visible with your telescopes. So what we're now doing is monitoring from the early first few seconds right up to as many days after the burst as we can actually see the object and see when it finally fades.
And that's continuous. The first few seconds to several days.
It's as continuous as we can possibly make it, and the reason for having more than one robotic telescope is to improve that continuity. So obviously, if we catch a burst on the island of La Palma with the Liverpool telescope, then the source sets or the sun rises at La Palma. We can't continue to monitor it. It's no longer nighttime in La Palma, but it's then nighttime in Hawaii. And so we do have campaigns where we then hand over to the Hawaii telescope and it can continue to monitor. By the time it's finished, if the brightness of the burst is still sufficient to use a 2-meter telescope to see it, we can then hand back to La Palma.
Right.
And we have larger telescopes that we have time on, for example, the 4-meter William Herschel telescope on La Palma, and also the larger 8-meter Gemini and VLT telescopes. And so we're able to hand over between these different telescopes. And with collaboration with different teams, we're able to monitor these light curves as long as we possibly can continuously.
We mentioned that there may be more gamma ray bursts going off in the universe, but we don't see all of them because not all of them are beamed towards us. But are we monitoring all of those gamma ray bursts? Are we detecting all those gamma ray bursts that do have their beams pointed towards us? Or don't we know? I guess I'm asking, how efficient is the SWIFT satellite? This satellite which is giving us all these alerts and warnings.
Yeah, there are two reasons why you would not catch bursts. So obviously there's the one you mentioned where if they're not beamed towards us, they don't flash in the gamma rays, and therefore, by definition, they are not a gamma ray burst in terms of an observational astronomer being able to see them. Therefore, we forget those. So that, there's a large majority of them probably, if you believe in the beaming model and then calculate how many are not beamed towards us. In terms of the ones that we should catch with the SWIFT satellite, this has certainly been a learning process for SWIFT instrument scientists. And obviously when you fly a mission like SWIFT, the first thing you do is you understand in your laboratory how sensitive your detectors are, and they use what's called a partial coded mask to catch the gamma rays. And this gives them a good view of the sky with also some directional information. But obviously you don't want to have many, many false positives, because that's very expensive in terms of other people's telescope time.
Wake you up in the middle of the night, for instance.
Exactly, and telling our robotic telescopes to follow up fake sources. And so the SWIFT team has worked very hard over the last 2 years to get the thresholds optimised. So obviously you start off being fairly conservative and you have some quite high thresholds and saying, well, there are lots of known sources that produce gamma ray bursts. So there's been a learning process in terms of building up a catalogue of known objects. There's also a phenomenon called the South Atlantic Anomaly, where SWIFT actually comes in and out of a zone where it can't point at the sky due to problems with the sun could produce problems in the detectors. And as they come in and out of that, obviously you can get these flashes of gamma rays in the detector, and they're not real sources either. So they've worked very hard to, because this is all fully automatic on SWIFT as well. You have to remember that it's not a human who's saying, well, that's not a real gamma ray flash, that is a real gamma ray flash.
Right.
And so they've worked very hard to get an optimal balance between how sensitive they are in terms of triggering on real gamma ray bursts without missing many of them, but also not having too many false positives. And so we do see that there's, obviously there are lots of gamma ray bursts that in the optical we can't follow up because it may be cloudy at the telescope, it may be raining. And so there are actually many more gamma ray bursts that have gamma ray data than may have optical data. And similarly, the X-ray instruments on board SWIFT, because SWIFT has a gamma ray detector, also an X-ray telescope and a small ultraviolet optical telescope. And so if the SWIFT satellite is able to see that part of the sky, it's able to get simultaneous gamma ray, X-ray, optical. But it may be that it's caught a gamma ray flash, it's about to be occulted, and so it might be another 20 or 30 minutes before it can then start to look for the X-rays and the optical light. So there's always, you know, something subtle about a small fraction of the bursts. But one thing that the SWIFT satellite has discovered, they're starting to find bursts at higher redshift than previous gamma ray satellite missions, such as, for example, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory and the Dutch Italian Beppo Sachs satellite found. And so they're actually finding slightly higher redshift objects that are fainter. And so we are apparently probing a slightly different kind of gamma ray burst. So we're finding a new population out there.
Why is that? Is it because SWIFT is more sensitive, or it's a better instrument?
SWIFT is more sensitive in the softer gamma ray bands. And this year there's also a harder gamma ray, or a higher energy gamma ray satellite called GLASS that will be launched, which again may probe a different kind of gamma ray burst. Because really, what you need to do is not only sample the whole of the electromagnetic spectrum, but sample all the gamma ray regime as well, because that's quite a broad band within the electromagnetic spectrum. And so you're catching bursts that have a range of different kind of gamma ray properties, and really hopefully we'll have a full census then of these kinds of objects.
Right. Thank you very much for talking to us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.